Welcome to episode 318 of the Ski Podcast, and thanks for joining us, listener. I'm your host, Ian Martin. Today, we're escaping the heat of summer by remembering last winter's Winter Olympics, going behind the scenes of the BBC's coverage, plus we'll be finding out about the ski resort of Pila in Italy. We'll also have the latest from the start of this season down under in Australia and New Zealand, and updates from GB Snowsport's new generation of alpine racers. Right, let's meet today's guests. My first guest has joined me many times on the podcast before, a four-time Winter Olympian herself. The last time we spoke, she had just joined Claire Balding on the BBC to cover the opening ceremony in Milan, and she was in Cortina trying to avoid the rain at the time. She is, of course, BBC Ski Sunday's Shemi Alcott. Hi, Shemi, how are you?
I am so excited to be doing reflective look back to an amazing winter whilst I am sweltering in the summer heat. I don't think I've ever talked to you about skiing whilst in the summer before.
Yeah, that's true. Whereabouts are you today?
I'm at home today. I'm in Hampton Court. My last few weeks at home before we start doing summer training. So head to Belgium for indoor camp and then Saas-Fee. I'm going to for some summer skiing this year.
Cool. That's exciting. This is part of the camps that you do with Dougie. You have a whole raft of young athletes that you coach through the summer.
Yeah, exactly. So we run a kind of full-time program for kids who are at full-time school in the UK. So it differentiates ourselves from a lot of the successful academies, because I do believe that you can be successful academically in the UK and go to school in the UK and also be a great skier and passionate about being your best. So that's kind of where we run our program.
Cool. Okay. Well, that's exciting. Coming up, going out to the Alps. Let me just introduce my second guest. My second guest is also a regular on the podcast. He most recently joined us in episode 262 to share his knowledge of the ski veldt in Austria. He has also been on the show talking about Narvik in Norway, what it's like skiing in Slovenia. I am delighted to welcome back freelance journalist Rob Rees. Hi, Rob. How are you?
I'm very well, Ian. It's great to be on the show again.
And remind me where you are today.
Well, I'm lucky to be in Italy. I'm in the Veneto, in a beautiful town called Asolo, which is the same as the mountaineering brand Asolo. And yeah, just staying in a beautiful hotel called the Villa Cipriani. So I've just had to tear myself away from the pool and a nice lunch. So, but obviously you're that important, Ian, I do that.
Well, I appreciate that, Rob. You're making me jealous. I would love to be in the mountains. I've done quite well this year, but I think this will be one of the few summers where I don't get out to the mountains. But thinking about them, a question I always like to ask my guests to start off with at the top of the show is, when did you ski or snowboard last? So, Shemi, when was that for you? When were you last out there on snow?
Well, I ski on snow on Monday at Hemel Hempstead. In fact, this whole kind of period of this heat wave, I've been indoor skiing quite a lot and it has been heaving. And I remember I went last Tuesday and apparently Hemel had an issue with the snow because it was so hot outside. They had these extra fans inside. But there was one school there that had 100 kids. And I went up to the teacher and I said, when did you book this? Because this can't be last minute because the whole world wants to be in a fridge right now. And she's like, no, they just got lucky. They booked this a long, long time ago. And there is something quite magical about walking in very small shorts and a tank top and then putting your ski stuff on, enjoying being cold. So I went from on the last week, I was videoing clients and my fingertips were cold. And I was like, oh, I'm going to be so excited in an hour when I'm out there sweating, playing pickle and paddle that my hands are freezing right now.
Cool. That's excellent. Actually, I had a conversation with Ian Brown, who is a CEO of the Snow Centre, earlier this week. And he was telling me that these very high temperatures are proving challenging for creating snow. But part of that conversation, we lent into sustainability. And it turns out that 90% of their energy that they create there is from sustainable sources. And in fact, later on this year, listener, I can tell you that I'm going to speak to the COO, if I've got my abbreviations and initials correct, of Snow World, who own the Snow Centre. And you mentioned you're skiing in Belgium. I think they own the property there as well. Landgraaf as well in Holland. They've got 11 different indoor centres. So that'll be really interesting when it comes up later in the year. What about yourself, Rob? When were you last on snow?
I was last on snow towards the end of March, and that was in Italy in the Aosta Valley. And I think the last day I skied was in Pila. And we were supposed to ski up at Crevecoeur, which is a lovely little resort up on the border to Switzerland on the Grand San Bernard Pass. But it was so windy that we had to cancel that day, and we had an extra day in Pila, which was absolutely wonderful. Perfect conditions, midweek, virtually nobody there. It was wonderful.
Beautiful. Well, we're going to be coming on to Pila a little bit later on and finding out more about that. Let's just turn our thoughts to where you can ski at the moment. Most of our listeners are in the Northern Hemisphere. We're in the middle of summer right now, but down under, the season is just starting, albeit slowly. Let's hear from Australia and New Zealand expert Rachel Oakes-Ash on how the season is shaping up.
Thanks, Ian. Great to be back for 2026. Although it's been a bit of a rough start. Australia and New Zealand ski season, well, we've all got off to a bit of a low tide. The New Zealand resorts all delayed their openings, and the Australian resorts rejoiced with snow the opening weekend, but that all then got washed away by rather warm rain. But there has been good news, and is good news currently right now, because Australia is currently in a storm cycle that started last night. Now, this is set to bring at least half a metre of snow, followed by some awesome snowmaking conditions, because the biggest issue has been we haven't had that wet bulb temperature that we've required in order to be able to make snow. June may have been a write-off, but July is carrying the load in good form so far. So the second week of the school holidays in Australia has theoretically been saved, that's for sure. Reporting this morning, after only 10 hours in the three-day storm or two-day storm, well, we'll see how long it lasts or how quickly it gets over. We've got up to, you know, I don't know, 24 centimetres in 10 hours so far, and there's a lot more forecast for today, particularly for the Victorian and New South Wales resorts. New Zealand's Otago resorts down near Queenstown and Wanaka, they had a decent storm about a week ago, and that meant that all those resorts could finally open, and more terrain was then able to be open throughout the week as their snowmaking conditions also improved. Mackenzie and Canterbury from this Sunday, these are the resorts up near Mount Hutt and Dobson and Rantel, all those little family-owned independent resorts, except for Mount Hutt, of course, which is a mega resort. They will have a decent storm from this weekend, from around Sunday, I think. They could see up to 80 centimetres, at least certainly Hutt could. I mean, they're known for getting big numbers. The Queenstown resorts will also benefit, but they'll get around 10 to 20 from the looks of it at the moment, because it's such a tough season to predict. We kind of are in a summer style cycle and models are all over the place. There's warm oceans. There's an El Nino pattern. The list goes on, but we'll certainly take what we can get. And the Australians, well, we're all dancing today and the Kiwis will be next.
Thanks to Rachel for that update. Let's hope that new snow continues. Listener, if you haven't listened to episode 312 yet, I strongly recommend you do. That is a special interview with Rachel. She really is an impressive woman with an incredible career behind her. She is not just the expert on snow sport down under. She is also a best-selling author, publicist, documentary producer, social media guru, and podcaster. You can catch up with that episode at skipodcast.com. Now, regular listeners might remember Guy Beetson reported for us from New Zealand last year. He's now based at Whakapapa. So let's hear how things are going there.
Thanks, Ian. Kia ora from New Zealand and from Whakapapa on the northern side of Mount Ruapehu in the central North Island. Whakapapa is one of New Zealand's major ski areas, but it is very different from the Alps. It sits on a big volcanic mountain in Tongariro National Park, with wide open terrain, dramatic lava formations, and weather that can change very quickly. The short version is winter is arriving, but the season is only just getting going. At the moment, Whakapapa is very much in early season mode. The road is open, the Skywalker gondola and visitor facilities are operating, Snowland is open, and skiing and snowboarding is opening when conditions allow. It's a similar story across much of New Zealand. A slow start after a mild June, but with colder weather now starting to put things back on track. The South Island looks better placed in the near term, with the Remarkables carrying one of the stronger early bases, and decent snow in the forecast for areas such as Mount Hutt, Mount Dobson, Round Hill, Treble Cone and Cadrona. The forecast is pointing to a colder, snowier spell from Sunday into Monday, with further light snow showers through the middle of the week. That could be enough to help the mountain shift from snowplay and sightseeing towards more genuine skiing and snowboarding, although it still depends on how much snow actually settles and what the wind does. So, cautious optimism is the mood at Whakapapa. The mountain is beautiful, cold and waking up, but we're still waiting for that proper winter base. And I'll be watching it closely because I'm working here this season as a ski instructor.
I got snowed into a lodge in Whakapapa for 4 days once. It was the most extreme conditions. We're in this lodge and the snow was so big outside that we couldn't get outside, couldn't open the door.
Wow. Well, I think Guy would be wishing for similar conditions to that, because it's definitely been a slow start there. There is some skiing in Europe just now. Several glaciers open in the Alps. Alex Irwin from the YouTube channel 150 Days of Winter skied last week in Teen. So let's hear what he thought of that.
Hi Ian, Alex from 150 Days of Winter with a snow report from Teens Grand Monarch Glacier. As France roasts in its hottest canicule in history, what better place to cool off at 3,000 metres above sea level in the French Alps? 20th of June was the opening day for Teens Glacier, a week later than Val d'Isère's at the Col de l'Isérin. If the question was what could get me out of bed at 5 a.m. on a Saturday morning, then the answer would be a perfectly pisted glacier. The most notable change this year was the disappearance of yet another of the chairlifts. The Lys lift has joined the long list of drag lifts that has been removed in an attempt to protect the ever-fragile mountain. Apart from the Grand Mont cable car, only two chairs and one drag remain. This year, the mountain was in near-perfect conditions. From 8 a.m. until midday, the snow conditions could not be faltered, even as it softened up later in the day. By the midday, a glimpse at a thermometer on a chairlift still was safely in single digits. As I finished this almost perfect morning, the temperature was 22 degrees in Val Carré, and as I descended the valley, so the mercury rose. 32 in Bourg, 34 in Moutier, only slightly cooler than hell itself. If my words don't eloquently do this justice, you can check out my glacier visit on my YouTube channel. So until my next snow report, ciao.
And then over on the other side of the Atlantic, Sunshine Village in Canada has opened for summer skiing for only the third time in their history. Kendra Schofield sent us this report.
Hi, Ian and Ski Podcast listeners. It's Kendra Schofield from Banff Sunshine Village, where we just did something kind of unique. We opened for 16 days of skiing and snowboarding on June 20th, and we'll be skiing and snowboarding all the way until July 5th. Now, Canada Day is July 1st, and that day celebrates when our country became the Dominion of Canada. And it's something that many Canadians hold tight. It's how we celebrate all things that are Canadian and what it truly means to be Canadian. And when I think about what are some of the most Canadian things, I think about, obviously, winter, skiing, Canadian tuxedos, poutine, Caesars. And so for Canada Day, we encouraged our skiers and snowboarders to dress in their finest Canadian tuxedos and join us on the slopes for our incredible Canada Day party, where we had a DJ playing mostly Canadian music. And we had over 1,000 skiers and snowboarders show up in their finest denim and take part in the Canada Day ski parade down Strawberry. Right now, we do have two chairlifts open, both Strawberry Express and Standish Express, and they'll be spinning for skiing until July 5th. Now, if you haven't summer skied before, I recommend adding it to your bucket list. It's high vibes, wear whatever you want, slather on the sunscreen, and have a good time.
Right, let's turn to our guest today. Shemi, it's great to have you back on the Ski Podcast. We last spoke during the Winter Olympics, and you did send us a short review after the Games. When I was thinking about what I was going to ask you for this episode, there are so many questions I would like to ask. But in that roundup, which I listened to the other day, you stressed how the Olympics are about more than just podiums and that too many of us live our life in comfort zones. And these Games saw a lot of athletes dare to dream by risking more than they normally would. So I guess firstly, I wondered if I could ask you about Mia Brooks and how her attitude towards daring to dream impressed you.
I think Mia is a very unique athlete who was willing in the world's biggest stage, all that global exposure, to put herself out there to not just progress herself, but the sport that she loves. And that's what you see in freestyle sports, whether that's, you know, skating or in the Summer Olympics or all of that in Livigno, was that everyone is doing it for the bigger picture. It's not just about having that gold around their neck. And they know that if they achieve their best, that is a byproduct of that. But actually what they want is to do something that no one in their sport has ever done before, like to show that progression. And to for Mia to stand and drop in on that last jump in the big air to try something that she'd never, ever done before. I mean, that takes an incredible amount of bravery and confidence. And I think that is something that resonates and needs to resonate with young girls, especially the next generation of athletes coming through. Actually, not just athletes, anyone. I speak to a lot of young people who are really living in their comfort zone. People are very scared to be excellent, because if you're excellent and you're pushing yourself 100%, like Mia did, you do open yourself up to mistakes and failure. If you live at 80%, you're always going to be good. Okay. And there is this issue that young people, actually not just young people, all of us have with perfection. We want to be perfect. And if you're perfect, that means you can't make mistakes. But if you're not making mistakes, you're not actually stepping outside that comfort zone. And nothing extraordinary ever happens when you're 80%. You've got to be willing to tip yourself into the limit of complete risk. And that's what she did that day. And actually, she over-rotated. This is the best thing about that story, because she didn't land it. She over-rotated. She went so big. And I just think that message is something that needs to be spread.
Yeah, and I think it's very interesting. I mean, that's probably an episode in itself about attitude to risk and exposing yourself. You need the failures to appreciate the success, but equally, you need to try these things, as Mia did the first time, to progress. Exposing yourself and bringing in that element of risk. You know, I have to ask you about Lindsay Vonn. She also dared to risk it all to go for gold. And in her case, it didn't end well. Now, her story was already the story of the Games. She'd come back from retirement. She was doing incredibly well, then helicoptered off the hill at Crans-Montana a few weeks before the Games. So like a lot of people, I think I tuned in on that Sunday morning to watch that race live, because it was, to me, the story of the Games. And I doubt anyone listening to this podcast doesn't know what happened. It was just awful to watch. And you know, I felt for you as well. I think we know each other pretty well. And I felt really bad for you, because you were clearly very upset about it. And if it's not too difficult, I wondered if you could talk us through what you went through from, you know, when Lindsay started that run.
Yeah, no, I would love to share that, because I think I know her incredibly well. I knew 2 years ago when she made the decision to come back to the sport that the only reason she was making that decision was for this 1:45 run in Cortina. And there was a big build up, and the first season didn't really go to plan until the finals, when she got that silver medal and everyone's like, okay, she has got it. She has opened herself up to a huge amount of judgment. You know, people really respected in our industry were like, what is she doing? She's got a knee replacement. This is dangerous. People had a voice on her body physically, which I didn't like, because until you know someone and you're in their head, you shouldn't be able to put their dreams down. So 2 years ago, her dream was to get in that start gate in Cortina. And if you know Lindsay, nothing will derail that. And we thought, you know, with that knee injury a week before, like you said, that would derail her. But then, you know, she starts putting out this content of her 3 days later doing incredible stuff in the gym, things that mere mortals like you and I wouldn't be able to do. But she is so strong that her knee is stable. And actually, the story starts bringing back hope again. And then the training runs come and she is competitive. She's definitely loading her right leg. Like watching that as an expert, like I could see that left side of her body was inferior in terms of strength and pain, but she was still fast. And if she's safe and she's being told by her surgeon she's okay to run, then great. And we're all on site going like, you, Ian, this is the story of the Games. But I never thought of an outcome where she wasn't in that finish winning or happy. Like I never went there. And I think probably that was a protection mechanism for me as well, because I've had quite a lot of emotional trauma from my own crashes. And I think that is also why I responded where I lost composure. You know, I'm a live pundit on television. You don't often see people lose control of their emotions like I did, but I did. And I was embarrassed. I really was quite embarrassed that I cried. I was very, very fortunate to have Hazel in the studio to help get me back to a safer subject, talking about technique.
Yeah, look, I think that's ridiculous that you'd be embarrassed about it, because it's not a normal situation when you're talking about, you know, someone who you know particularly well. But I think when the run started, I mean, after 13 seconds in, it was very, very quick. From the bottom, were you aware? You must be relying on the same coverage that we were watching at the same time.
Yes. No, you know, we watched holding our breath for 13 seconds. The 13 seconds that she did ski, she had the bravery and the confidence to ski a line that no other athlete had skied yet. She skied tighter in the fall away, loading that left leg. That's really important to say. Very different from the training runs. She was taking that risk. She was going for the win, loading that left leg. And actually what happened is in the compression fall away, she loaded it so much that actually the ski, the left ski gripped and she went in too hard to the gate panel. And that's where it came out. And I had a lot of arguments with fellow broadcasters who I felt were clickbaiting, saying, well, this happened because of her knee. And I was like, no, this happened because she chose to take a money line. She chose to go for the winning line. And there were a lot of debates that went on. And, you know, I will stick to my guns because I think I know Lindsay. I know the attitude that her team were taking. But what we did hear in the finish is we could hear the screams, like the travel of the sound that came down the valley. And that was horrendous. And the atmosphere in the finish, I mean, I've had one finish atmosphere like that working on Ski Sunday, and that was when Kilder crashed in Wengen. And he crashed right in front of us, and it was horrendous. But the silence, the respect from the Swiss crowd that day, and when we saw the tourniquet coming in for Kilder, I mean, it was crazy. And the same with Lindsay. There was this weird, like, clapping where the crowd were trying to will her up. It was very, very bizarre and emotional.
Yeah, you could sense that confusion in the crowd at the bottom where people were trying to understand and certainly getting a fix on the gravity of the situation and, you know, those screams. And I think when, you know, the BBC first cut to you for your comments, I noticed there was no video. You were just speaking. And, you know, my sense was that you were just too upset to appear on screen at that time.
Yeah, I mean, they gave me the choice. They said, are you ready? And I was like, yes, because I think this story needs to be told. I mean, I'm in this incredibly grateful position, privileged position, to be in the finish of this Olympic downhill. It costs the BBC a lot of money to have us on site, but I'm here to tell the story and tell people what I'm feeling from the crowd to myself as an ex-athlete. So I said, yes, I am. I was willing to go on crying. I was willing to share what everyone was feeling. And that actually, that lack of composure, whatever, it makes it so much more relatable, because I think I showed what everyone at home was feeling as well. And it was just a crazy day. And you look at the fateful situation of who she had at the start gate, who was able to go in the helicopter with her. So her surgeon, who she'd flown over from America, was at the start. And he was the one, not the American Olympic team doctor, which was who normally would go in a helicopter with an athlete. She chose and got the authority to have him with her. He's the only one with her. And in the end, having him there in that start gate has saved her leg. Without him there, she would have had her leg amputated. We know that now.
Right. I mean, I'm aware this may be out of date, but I think she's had 8 surgeries since then.
Yeah.
I read an interview recently. She was not ruling out skiing again. Do you think she'd ever ski again or even race again? Is that at all feasible?
I also read that, Ian, and I think that if she can have the enjoyment to ski again, that will be the most wonderful show of resilience ever. I just think that will be incredible. Racing again, that's a whole another ball game. It's a whole other risk that she would take, but it's her body, it's her choice, it's her mind. You know, Lindsay loves ski racing, and she came back and she loved it when she wasn't winning as well. So I think it's just amazing that she put herself out there as another kind of legendary status for us all.
It is, and I guess will continue to be an amazing story. And just out of interest, I think it's also indicative of the ability of top athletes now to keep performing at an age much older than historically typical. You look at Lindsay Vonn. I mean, you saw Serena Williams play Wimbledon the other day, who's competing in her 40s. The World Cup, which is going on at the moment, has got more 40 plus age players in it than have competed ever before in the World Cup. So who knows? Maybe she will come back. Segue slightly more positively. GB Snowsport won their first ever gold medal during the Games, Hugh Nightingale and Charlotte Banks in the snowboard cross. Am I right that you were watching that and kind of going crazy watching it in a service station on the motorway?
Oh, so yes, you are right. And it's a very bizarre one. I had begged since day one to be able to get over to Bormio to be there for Dave Riding's last race. And it was all up in the air until the very last minute. And then because of the biathlon results, there was a who I could go with over to Bormio. So last minute, we got in the car. I mean, it's not close. It's 8 hours. And we drove over. And I was streaming it on my phone on the way. And I just said, we've got to pull over. We've got, I can't handle this. We have to pull over for the final. And I was there. And it happened to be that there was this giant TV just above the bathroom, the toilet, in this service station. So, you know, most people are in there having their coffees, trying to go to the bathroom. And I am just shouting at the television. And it was, I think I was so into the Olympics. I, you know, I'm such a big fan that I couldn't really control my passion. And it was just so exciting. It was amazing.
Well, you mentioned, you know, getting over from Cortina to Bormio. Big trip. The reason you were there was for Dave Ryding's last race. I actually watched your little interview with him at the... And was it you who had the champagne on ice that you pressed into his hand?
It's very hard to get that champagne to him. Everyone's like, no, we can't, because it was actually quite far from where the bars were to the finish area because of the nature of the stands. But I happened to see someone I knew and I was like, you've got to get me some champagne so that I can give Dave some champagne. But he was like, are you sure this is a, you know, he's so athletic minded. He was like, is there anything in this champagne? I'm like, yes, Dave, it's pure champagne.
Right, you're thinking about drug testing afterwards. Yeah, he's concerned that side of things. Wouldn't want to do a, I don't know, an Alan Baxter or something like that. And afterwards, shortly after that, he gate crashed another piece that you did to camera.
I mean, Dave and I know each other incredibly well, and I thought that was kind of the beauty of it. He's walking past at the end and he's a bit happier now because everything has settled. And he's like, are you still talking? And puts his arms around me, thinking that, because on Ski Sunday, we don't do things live that often, actually, only if a race overruns. So he's thinking that everyone will be able to edit this out. And I'm like, yes, Dave, and we're live. So I run into Jeanette's show. And it's just, you know, it's lovely to have that rapport with someone. And again, to be able to celebrate him and what he's done for British skiing.
Cool. Well, we've talked about Dave many times on the Ski Podcast before, and I think I can refer people to episode 199, special interview that I did with him, which goes his life in real detail. Can I ask you about something that's possibly a bit more dry as a topic, but they've had some FIS elections. I think some listeners to the podcast wouldn't know about this. This was for president of FIS, and the incumbent, also the CEO of Head Skis, Johan Eliash, I think his name, was beaten in the closest vote possible by Alexander Osbelt of Liechtenstein. The vote was 65-64. Mm-hmm. Can I ask you your thoughts on that? Are we going to see any change, you know, for racers because of this new presidency?
I think regardless of who was elected, we have to see change. I think there is so much that needs to happen. And the rumours preceding that election were huge. I mean, there was talk that Kitzbühel and Wengen were going to make their own race series, which is what we've seen in a lot of other sports, and come together. Some of the classics were going to leave. And I think everyone knows that something needs to change for the future and the sustainability of our sport going forward and the safety of the athletes. Lots needs to change. I can imagine behind closed doors right now, they are ripping up the what has happened before and starting again, because I think that needs to happen. I think our sport is amazing. We have incredible global fans, but I think it does. It is an opportunity for growth and for change, and it needs to start now.
Cool. Well, I hope that we see that. You know, I know, if I understand it correctly, that the previous incumbent burnt through a lot of cash reserves in a relatively short period of time. So, you know, FIS's coffers are a lot lower than they used to be. I noticed that GB Snowsport's Vicky Gosling was going to stand for president at one point. She's now on the council. Do you think that'll British gears in any way, having a British representative on the council?
Yeah, I think always. I think we are a small but mighty nation. I think the fact that Vicky is on there shows that people respect our opinion, the grit that the Brits have shown to make a pathway for a small nation needs to be celebrated. And having Vicky there, it can't just be about what the Austrians, the Swiss, the French and the Americans want. It's got to be able to be a global interest in our sport. And so I think Vicky will really help represent that.
Cool. Excellent. Well, I mentioned, or I referred to the next generation of British Alpine racers in the introduction about the future of British skiing. Regular listeners will know the Ski Podcast has been helping support that next generation. Over the last couple of winters, we've helped the Carrick-Smith brothers financially. And while our sport is only a drop in the ocean of their costs, it's been really exciting to see all three of Luca, Freddie and Zach make their World Cup debuts during that time. We have an update from the boys on their close season so far. So let's hear how they're getting on.
Hey guys, it's Luke here. I thought I'd give you a quick update on how training has been going over the last few months, because it's been a while since the last one. After the winter, we had a bit of a break and a fitness camp. And then we went on a ski camp in Les Deux Alpes, which was really, really good this year. We had some great training. It was super quiet. Me and Zach have swapped skis, which is really exciting. We've swapped a brand called Van Deer. We tested at the end of the year and we really liked it. And we were just able to get the support we needed from them. So for us, that is very exciting. The ski is very good. I find it's a little stiffer than the Dinistar, so I can get a little bit more out of the turns and just carry the speed in between the turns quite well. Yeah, so we spent 2 weeks training in the Deux Alpes on the snow. And then in Austria, we went to Austria for a fitness block and a testing block, which was also great, where we had great training preparing for when we go to New Zealand in August. Me, Zach and Freddie will all be going to New Zealand to compete in the South races to try to get our points down before the winter season starts and to try to really get us on form before the first races. We're all very excited about going to train in New Zealand because it gives us an edge over a lot of the competitors and it gives us something we've not had before, which is extra training throughout the summer and preparation for the winter's racing. First of all, next week we're going to be heading to an indoor camp to train for 4 or 5 days and really get all the equipment sorted before we head down to New Zealand for the summer. It's a place called Hamburg in Germany and it should be really good because you get loads and loads of laps in on ice. They've injected it, so it should be really good snow. Thank you so much, guys, for listening in, and we'll keep you updated with how the summer training goes.
It's Freddie Hacksmith here. I'd give you guys a quick update on the last few months, or since I was last on the podcast. It's been pretty, pretty exciting. We did some skiing in Les Deux Alpes in France, which was insane. We caught it when it was super quiet and the snow was super good. So that was awesome. And we had some new coaches there as well, because Red Bull provided us with some coaches. So that was pretty sick. And well, Luke and Zach switched to Van Deer, so they got service tech. And then we headed down to Salzburg for 2 weeks of full-on fitness training with Red Bull, so that was pretty full on. And then we headed up to Scotland to visit family, and I'm in England now, just a break before we go skiing in Wittenberg in Germany in the indoor dome for like 3 days. Now I get 10 days off, and then we head straight to New Zealand. So 6 full on weeks, that's super exciting. I've never been, so I'm looking forward to that. Thanks for listening and have a good day.
So, Shemi, you interviewed the boys at the London Snow Show last year, and you know their parents, Emma and Phil, well. I think both you and Emma were at the 2002 Olympics together, at least. What do they need to go and take it to the next level?
Oh, I mean, in terms of their control and what they're doing and their inputs, they are ticking every box. The talent, the fire, the drive, the physicality. It's just about being able to support 3 completely individual skiers, be able to get to the top. I think we cannot see them as a trio anymore because their strengths lie in different places. And that's where it's hard for Emma and Phil, because they've got 3 sons with different needs, different races they need to go to, different parts of Europe or the world. And they're trying to divide up and conquer it all. So actually, I think as much as they're an amazing unit because they train together and push each other in training, when it comes to the races, they've got to have that individual sponsorship, fundraising program. They have to have their own programs for them in order to succeed, because otherwise one of them will always be sacrificing for the others.
Yeah, always a challenge. I've seen some video of your 2 boys racing. They look pretty good. Would you see them going into competitive skiing at all?
I mean, I've got yin and yang. My eldest is a mini, me and Dougie. He's so competitive. He absolutely loves it. He puts full effort in. And my youngest just wants to make friends and does it for the Haribo. So I have to adapt my parenting skills massively. I think Cooper might be that kind of outside racer that comes to it quite late on in life, because he's had so much opportunity and volume. Whereas Lockie's drive means that, I mean, he's already winning races. And I love that because he does have a target on his back. And, you know, the Carrick Smiths had the same with Emma as their parents. You know, they're growing up in this system where everyone expects a lot from them. I mean, I'm slightly different because my sons go to state school in the UK. But as soon as we get to a race, I mean, Lockie doesn't even have my surname. They're Crawfords. But people are like, oh, that's Shemi and Dougie's son. He must be good. And I'm like, no, just let him be him. So the Carrick Smiths have shown that they can handle that pressure. My boys love the Carrick Smiths, like obsessed. with them, and they give them so much time and energy. And I think it's because maybe they see themselves in them because they've got the same passion for snow sports.
Cool. Well, I mean, that's interesting to hear. Who knows? Maybe they'll be the next generation. That is really interesting, Shemi. Thank you for all of your time there and your input on all different aspects of the Winter Olympics from last year. If it's okay with you, I'm going to turn to Rob now, and we will find out a little bit about Pilar. Now, back in episode 211, Katie Bamber was telling us about Champalouc in the Oster Valley. And not very far away from there is Pilar. So, Rob, I wondered if we could start off, if you could explain where it is, how it fits into the geography of the Aosta Valley.
Okay, well, the Aosta Valley is sort of starts not that far from Turin and then ends up in the Mont Blanc Tunnel. It's an autonomous province. It's the smallest province in Italy. So it's up in that little corner, the other side of Chamonix. Obviously, the sort of leading resort is probably Courmayeur. You come down the main dual carriageway and Aosta is sort of about a third of the way down there. But near Courmayeur, you have La Tuile, which goes across to La Rosière as well. And then you have, obviously, Chavigne, which links over to Zermatt. And then you have the Monterosso ski area, which is a delightful area. The Val d'Ayas, which has Champalouc, Alagna and Gressonay. So there's plenty of skiing, plus there's some little day resorts like Cogne and Crevecoeur. So it's, but Aosta is the sort of county town, if you like.
Cool. And some people would have heard of the Aosta Valley. They might not realise there is actually a town called Aosta. And when you skied in Pilar, you were staying in Aosta. Is that right?
Yeah, we stayed in this lovely hotel near the Piazza Narbonne called the Duca Hotel. And we just basically took the car every day to this very unprepossessing car park behind a supermarket, went to this ancient ski art shop, and we just clipped in and went on this wonderful new gondola. They've invested £60 million in this gondola that takes you up from effectively the edge of the town. And the first thing you go over is the autostrada, main autostrada I talked about from Mont Blanc Tunnel to Turin. So it's a bit surreal because you go up about 1200 meters in the lift and you go up to Pilar, which is like their equivalent of a purpose-built resort, so much nicer than, say, a Val Thorens or a Sestriere, but actually quite a nice resort called Pilar, which has had a lot of money spent on it, and it's been refurbished, and a lot of the buildings have been reclad to make them look much more authentic. But you come from this Roman, ex-Roman town, to this sort of ski station, to this wonderful south-facing, north-facing plateau. So,
just to go back, you mentioned it's a Roman town. I recall going to Aosta one time, and they do have like a little mini amphitheatre that you can walk around and get a sense of that history.
Yeah, there's an amphitheatre. There's a couple of big sort of Roman gates. It was set up in 25 BC as a Roman barracks by Augusta Praetoria. So there's a Praetoria gate, and there's a Via Quadrivia, which is where the two passes meet, the Grand San Bernard and the Petit Bernard. And that's one of the reasons why they sort of got it, because it was obviously where the two passes met, which were obviously where all the goods were transited and all the various things that the Roman Empire needed. So it was a very important town. And obviously because where it sits, you know, it's a bit of a gateway, really, to Mont Blanc and all that stuff. And so it was fought over by many different people over the years. But it's very unique culture. It's one of those valleys that I've got to like more and more, very much like I like some of the outlying resorts in the Dolomites. It's just got a very distinctive feel, distinctive architecture. It's a pretty steep valley. And the guy I went with, Neil, he's been up and down that valley so many times, but he's never, you know, stopped off. So it's very easy to bypass, but it's got a very, you know, distinct identity, and I like it more and more I go there. So,
yeah, it's definitely worth going. And in fact, when I went to Courmayeur, I'm going to say it was about 2 years ago now, I discovered they have their own dialect there, because there's been this mix between France, that it was part of the Duc de Savoie kingdom,
right,
I think,
yeah.
Until, I don't know, check my history, but 1860, I think, when with the Risorgimento, like that, it became Italian. But they have their own dialect there that is different from Italian, different from French. Just back to Pilar then. So I have been there to Aosta. I did ski in Pilar, and I recall taking the lift up. You can stay in Pilar itself as a ski resort, can't you?
You can, and I think as a resort, it's you know, it's the nearest thing other than, say, Sestriere, which is ski in, ski out. And it's a much nicer looking sort of on-mountain resort than a lot of the French resorts. So they've tried to make it much more sympathetic, and they've invested quite a lot of money in it, obviously together with this brand new cable car. But you can stay up there. I think it's an ideal place for families, and it's an ideal place for improving skiers, because there's lots of different, you know, there's blues, there's some absolutely brilliant blacks, and there's some reds. It's a really good area, 70 kilometres worth of skiing. And for me, it's like the perfect short break or sort of beginners improving intermediates resort.
Oh, so I think you mentioned the resort itself, you know, Pila level, was it 1,200 or a bit higher than that? What does it go up to?
No, you know, it's 1,800 metres, so it's a decent height. And you go up from Aosta, you rise 1,200 metres from Aosta in this new six-stage gondola. So, yeah, it's at a decent height, and the resort tops out at 2,700 metres, and it's sort of north to northwest facing. So it keeps its snow pretty well. And we were there at the end of March. We had two unbelievable days.
And that top station is also served by a new lift with a new restaurant at the top there as well?
That's right. The whole thing's been based on this Stella de Pia project, and they've added in three extra stops, which has really opened up the whole resort. It's opened up a whole new area around the Cui area, and there's a whole set of blacks off there, and it's sort of added about 30 kilometres worth of skiing and some really, really good runs. And when you get to the top, this is a star-shaped restaurant with a number of viewing platforms, and you can look south and you can look at towards places like Konya, Grand Paradiso, and then you look north, you can look at the Grand Combin, you look at Monte Bianco, Monte Cervino, that's obviously the Matterhorn, you look across to the Monte Rosso area. It's quite special, yeah, very special. You see some really close up to some mountains, and within that Stella de Pia, they've got a lovely restaurant which does all the sort of typical Valdostanian dishes.
Right, now starting to talk about what Italy is also very famous for, which is the gastronomy. Not only do you get fantastic food, but I think it would be fair to say that the prices in Pila, and I'm sure in Aosta as well, are extremely good relative to, let's say, some of the bigger ski resorts we might know.
Absolutely, 100%. Yeah, there's quite some very decent fare up in that Stella de Pia. It's run by the same people who run the Skyway Monte Bianco. So it's quite a sort of modern take on the dishes. There's lots of very ordinary type bars and restaurants scattered around the village and on the hillside. And obviously, when you go back to Aosta, it's just a normal working town. So you're going to proper trattoria, proper steak and pizzerias. It's just very normal, good value.
Well, I have been to Pila before. And when I went there, it was actually for the SIGB ski test, which regular listeners will know that our equipment expert, Al Morgan, goes out to that. It was most recently held in Champalupa at the time. It's held in Pila for several years. And I think a large British tour operator for schools, Interski, are based in Aosta and do their skiing up in Pila. Who would you say the area is suitable for?
Well, I think with this new lift investment, I think it's opened itself up to bigger audiences. On the days we were there, we saw the hordes of Interski students with their blue big bibs on. They were sort of pouring out of the various cable cars. It's definitely a place for families, definitely a place for learners. But I think it's, for me, it's almost one of the perfect short break destinations. It's only just over an hour and 20 minutes from Turin Airport. If you want to go via Geneva and pay the Mont Blanc Channel charge, it's a couple of hours. But for me, you can have millionaires skiing midweek. There's flights out of Gatwick that go straight into Turin. Turin's a very user-friendly airport, very easy to get through, although we were the guinea pigs for this new entry system when we were there. It was a bit chaotic, but I think that's all been ironed out. But I would go for a group of decent skiers. There's a lot of blacks there, black runs, and there's some restaurants scattered around. It's perfect for everybody, really. And there's long, sweeping runs. And, I mean, you can just live on the views, frankly.
And you've become a convert to the Aosta Valley over the last few years. I know you've been there several times. Basing yourself in Aosta, you mentioned you had a car. Did you do any side trips to other resorts as well?
Yeah, we did. We went up to La Tuile. We got caught on a very cold, windy day up in La Tuile, but that's got some great black runs that were sort of open. And we also spent some time in Cormeo, which I found delightful. I mean, I've not skied in Cormeo before, but that's, again, it's a compact resort, but it's very upmarket. You obviously get very different perspectives on Mont Blanc. Obviously, it's on the sunnier side, and it doesn't have that sort of more hip and happening vibe that Chamonix sort of cultivated over the last few years. It's just a very nice Italian town. And so we loved it. And obviously, in previous times, I've skied in Cervinia and Champalupa. So there is so much skiing in the valley. They don't tend to have a valley pass, which is slightly frustrating, and that's because the Italian resorts aren't that good at keeping up with each other. But I know that there are some resorts that are on the Icon Pass. So Cormeo is on the Icon Pass. So we came across a lot of Americans. They were then going up. Sham is on the Icon Pass, and obviously Zermatt. So there was quite a lot of Americans in the valley, which was, you know, nice to see.
Yeah, and I think there's some strange anachronism that Pila is perhaps on the Indy Pass. Is that right?
It could be. I'm not totally sure. No.
I'll double check that one. I'll include it. And if it isn't, I won't. Right. Shemi, can I ask you a quick question? Is it my imagination or have you previously done race camps in La Tuile in the Oster Valley?
Yeah, we've done a lot of work for the last 4 years, starting our winter in La Tuile. It's an amazing first destination before Christmas because it's north facing. They're really good at preparing the snow. Last year, we had some incredible powder days. Also, I've been to Pila quite a lot, and I love staying down. It's quite a unique atmosphere for me where I travel around the winter staying in mountain resorts to go to Pila, and I love staying down in Aosta, like walking around the town, feeling like you're on a city break, but then you go and ski all day and you come back down. And, you know, for me, there's laundrettes there. So that ticks a massive box. Like I can. But yeah, it's such a different vibe. I really love that. Great cake shop. I mean, probably two good cake shops. But I've actually, when you were listing off, Rob, all those places, I've done races in Crevecole, I've done races in Pila, beautiful race hill, loads of undulating terrain, wide piece. Our parents of our ski racers love it because it's the most amazing restaurant where they can sit on the deck and watch the whole race coming down for. Mm-hmm. We've also stayed up there, Rob, in some of those purpose-built resorts, and that is super good for young kids.
Sure. And with La Tuile, I'm pretty sure that they are investing for next season in a better connection for the lift that connects over to La Rosière, which will improve things over there. Well, I've been, yeah, you don't want to make it so easy. You want to keep the Tuile to yourself.
I like those old school pommers. I like the old school pommers and the threat that you have that if you can't do this pommer and you're going to fall off, it's a 500 euro, what do we call it?
Skidoo.
The skidoo, it's like you've got to be good enough to make this, otherwise you will not get home.
It's so interesting how all of these ski areas fit together. You know, regular listeners, when I was out in Saint-Foy in March, and we were skiing the backcountry, and with our guide, we went up one ridge, and suddenly he says, oh, this is the border to Italy, and over there I can see the La Tuile ski area, and all of this over there. It was really, really enjoyable. Well, that's fantastic, Rob. Thanks very much for that insight into Pila. We're just going to move towards the close now. I love getting feedback from our listeners. Let me know what you've enjoyed so far. If you have ideas for future features, you can leave a comment on Spotify, Instagram, or Facebook. Our handle is @SkiPodcast, or drop me an email to theskipodcast@gmail.com. We're also on WhatsApp. I release exclusive material ahead of each episode there. So look in the show notes for those links. We have had some feedback since our last episode. Alistair Yule said, love listening to Victoria in episode 309. Got to have her back with her daughter, Mila, who has qualified for the Free Ride World Tour. Now, that is great to hear, Alistair. And I have to tell you that Victoria told me it was a real pleasure for her to answer questions about her own life for a change, rather than being quizzed about her husband, who is Xavier de la Rue, and her daughter, Mila de la Rue. So she was actually quite relieved that I didn't bring any of that up. Colin Tierney, he said episode 314 about Zag skis was really interesting. He also says, I watched a video of Ronin skis in Chamonix, where you can make your own skis over 2 days. Well, listen to the end of this episode, Colin, and I have some good news for you about Ronin skis. And Neil Landon said, thoroughly enjoying your podcast, especially 313 on Chamonix. It's nearly 40 years since I skied there, and it brings back fond memories. He also goes on to say, in relation to 4 about Zag skis, the first rocketed skis were not Zags. They were Volant Spatula, designed by Shane McConkie and released in 2001. Now, I asked our equipment expert, Al Morgan, about this. He said, it's a great question. There's debate on lots of this. It wasn't called rocker with a spatula. They called it decamber or reverse camber. And that ski was in the early noughties, the Zag Big 84 or Freeride 75. They were the first couple of models. I think K2 claims the first rocker skis were developed by Shane McConkie with them. But that was later, around 2005. So these things are always tricky and interesting. Al says, it may be true KT was the first company to use rocker, but we'll never know. Right, there are now 318 episodes of the Ski Podcast to catch up with. 121 of those were listened to in the last week. So if you'd like to keep your ski fix going over the summer, go to theskipodcast.com. I have a search around the tags and categories, and I'm sure you'll find something of interest to listen to over the summer. I can also tell you that most of our listeners in the last week were in the UK, 21% in North America, and 7% down under in Australia and New Zealand, with everyone else spread as far and wide as Peru, Morocco, and Indonesia. So that is it for this week. The Ski Podcast will be back next week for the 5th of our Chamonix stories, and that will be an interview with Jono Jacobs, founder of Ronin Skis, a very special independent ski brand based in Chamonix. If you do enjoy the podcast and you want to help out, you are very welcome to buy me a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/theskipodcast. But for now, I would like to thank my guest today. Shemi, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
And Rob, thank you.
Thank you.
And finally, listener, thank you for joining us wherever in the world you're listening right now. And until next time, goodbye.